Well, we're going to come to our kind of Bible study. If you've been coming at all regularly, you'll know that we've been looking through the book of Acts. But we're going to have a little bit of a break from our series through Acts. We'll carry on with it next week. But one of the things that's come up as we've looked through Acts is the whole issue of signs and wonders. Chris was mentioning earlier about the miracles Jesus performed. Well, the apostles performed lots of miracles as well. Rich Owen, in fact, was speaking on one passage where they prayed for signs and wonders. He said the official position at Avenue on signs and wonders is that Graham will cover it later. And I was wondering about trying to fit it in within a sermon somewhere, but always felt like that meant that the rest of the sermon got squashed. So he thought, why not take a break and have a one-off thing, just thinking about signs and wonders as a topic. And so that's what we're doing this morning. It is 20 years ago, almost exactly, that this book, Power Evangelism, was first published by a guy called John Wimber. It created something of a storm of controversy back in the mid-80s. I remember going to a conference, actually, in 1987, and there was a seminar at the conference on signs and wonders. And I remember thinking, I wonder what they are. Because I was a student at the time, I'd never heard of them, hadn't been a Christian that long. And the whole reason they had a seminar on signs and wonders was specifically responding to this book and the controversy it raised. The general thesis of John Wimber's book is that we can and we should perform miracles like we read about in the Acts of the Apostles. And that if we don't, our evangelism today will be rather ineffective. Now, I think John Wimber says a number of things in this book that are absolutely fine. He puts some things very well. He says some things I think are more debatable. And I'm sorry to say that he says some things I think are frankly awful. For example, I'll give you a few examples just to give you the feel of how this kind of issue starts to broaden and some of the things that come into play. So, for example, he said that if you haven't had signs and wonders as part of your becoming a Christian, if some miraculous events haven't surrounded your becoming a Christian, you have had, and I quote, an inadequate conversion experience that will retard your growth as a Christian. Wow. Another example. He said of those people who thought that evangelism today was simply telling people the gospel in obedience to the Great Commission, he said, he sort of described them as spreading the gospel in an indiscriminate way, relying on a prepackaged message rather than relying on the power of God. Wow. He said how healing was available today. And he sort of depends how you read him on this, but at the very least, he strongly suggested that if people weren't healed, it was because of a lack of faith. Now, for all I know, John Wimber may have changed his mind on all those things since this book was published. I only have a first edition of it, he's since died. He died of cancer, actually, which raises some questions in your mind. But I mention those things now, not to sort of, you know, slate the book and say what an awful thing it is necessarily, but just to raise the breadth of issues this touches on. You see, just in those examples with signs and wonders, we have questions of our own Christian experience. Have I missed out in some way? We have our attempts at evangelism. Are we going about it completely the wrong way? We have issues of our expectations of God working miraculously just in general, like in healing, outside of evangelism or anything like that. And my point is simply, this covers a huge area, and we can't cover all of it this morning. What I want to do is to focus on one of those things I've just mentioned, and that is signs and wonders and evangelism, because that's really how we've met it in the book of Acts. We can't have missed the fact that part of the spread of the message of the gospel was miracles. In fact, as I mentioned at the beginning, there was even a prayer to that effect. Acts 4, verse 30, the believers prayed to God, "Stretch out your hand to heal and perform miraculous signs and wonders through the name of your holy servant Jesus." And the big question is, should we pray that prayer? And that's what I'm going to try and answer. And at the end, I'll put that back up and say, should we pray those words? So, just a small task. Okay, let's think about what we're talking about first of all. Let's go to signs and wonders. What are they? Because this is a phrase that is used in the Bible. Sometimes it's miraculous signs, sometimes it's wonders, but most commonly it's signs and wonders. They're a pair. The wonders bit simply means something amazing, something wonderful, and hence it's usually something miraculous, often healings of some kind, but it can be broader than that. For example, the plagues on Egypt are referred to as wonders. Some people would include things like miraculous rescues from prison that we've seen in Acts, that sort of thing. It's something amazing. But the sign means it's something significant. That is, it's not just a, wow, isn't it amazing? Get on with life. It points you to something. That's what a sign does, isn't it? It points you in the right direction. It points something out to you, something that you should then focus your attention on. And that fact straight away should tell us that these things aren't ends in themselves that you look at and wonder at. They point you to something. They're directing your attention to something else. Well, what do they direct us to? Well, let's just do a quick survey. Let's go to the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, signs and wonders are linked especially with the events of the Exodus coming out of Egypt. So I'll give you a couple of examples. The Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and outstretched arm, with great terror and with miraculous signs and wonders. And you get that sort of description of what God did in the Exodus very commonly, both in Exodus and in Deuteronomy, which looks back at it. And it's worth noticing that the main way these are viewed are kind of evidence for people as to what God has done. They happen as part of this great event, and then people should look back at them and say, remember the amazing things that God did. So another example, within Exodus itself, the context here is God talking to Moses about how he'll perform these signs and wonders, and he says he's going to do it that you may tell your children and grandchildren how I dealt harshly with the Egyptians, how I performed my signs among them. And then later on, like in the Psalms, we get kind of accusations of people who forget these things. So Psalm 78, talking at people who've turned away from God, they forgot what he had done, the wonders he had shown them. He did miracles in the sight of their fathers in the land of Egypt. They've forgotten what God did in these signs and wonders. So, as a very broad brush look at the Old Testament, you get this big splurge of signs and wonders in coming out of Egypt, and then you get people called to look back and remember those things. But it's not quite as neat as that, because the signs and wonders do carry on. I would suggest they carry on just more sporadically. So, for example, Daniel. This is Daniel 6, Lion's Den. And the king says, God rescues and saves, he performs signs and wonders. In the heavens and on the earth, he's rescued Daniel from the power of the lion. So this rescue is clearly seen as a sign and a wonder. So big events back in the Exodus, and then some continuing throughout Old Testament history. Within that, if you looked back at the Exodus ones, I should mention the way they function is particularly to say that God is with Moses. It's like they validated Moses as God's spokesperson. And here, it points out that God is with Daniel. And that idea of God sort of validating or saying, I'm with somebody, we'll come back to that in just a second. Let's move to the New Testament. Here, it's linked primarily with Jesus and with the apostles. And if you know your New Testament, you'll know that pretty reasonably. So I'll get a couple of examples. Acts chapter 2, Peter, talking to some Jews, talks about Jesus, and he says, Jesus of Nazareth was a man accredited by God to you, how? By miracles, wonders, and signs, which God did among you through him. So Jesus was accredited by these signs and wonders. It was known they accompanied him. But then they go with the apostles as well. First of all, Acts 2, many wonders and miraculous signs are done by the apostles, just a summary statement. Another one comes in chapter 5, the apostles performed many miraculous signs and wonders among the people. And then later on with Paul, God did extraordinary miracles through Paul and goes on to give some examples of how you could take a handkerchief from Paul and take it to somebody and they'd get better and that sort of thing. However, some other people do them as well. So next week we'll read about Stephen, who wasn't one of the apostles. The week after that we'll read about Philip, who wasn't one of the apostles. And they do miracles, which are called signs and wonders, as well. And we'll come back to that. So there's a brief overview. What about the purpose of signs and wonders? What are they for? Well, I've given a hint already. I think the best way of thinking about them is as God's stamp of approval on someone. God's stamp of authenticity. It kind of proves the authenticity of the person and the message they bring. So, a few examples. Come back to that one in Acts chapter 2, first of all. Jesus of Nazareth was a man accredited by God to you. So this is how God accredited Jesus, how he said, I'm with him, gave a stamp of authenticity to him. Get similar words used with the apostles. Paul and Barnabas spent time, this is in Antioch in Acts 14, speaking boldly for the Lord, who, what did he do? Confirmed the message of his grace by enabling them to do miraculous signs and wonders. So there's an accreditation, a confirmation coming in. And then one more from Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 2. This salvation was first announced by the Lord, that's Jesus, and it was confirmed to us by those who heard him. So this person saying, we heard it from the apostles. God also testified to it by signs, wonders, and various miracles. So you see, we've got three words there: accrediting it, confirming it, testifying to it. And that's why I say I think it's this stamp of authenticity. And that goes along with what Paul calls the marks of an apostle. In 1 Corinthians 12, he refers to the things that mark an apostle: signs, wonders, and miracles. And you can kind of put that together, because the apostles were like God's official spokespeople. After the events of Jesus' death and resurrection and ascension, they were the ones who could say, this means da-da-da-da-da. Jesus died for our sins. God, he is the Messiah. They could put it all together. And God authenticated what they said with signs and wonders. And I think that's why it's primarily the apostles that we see doing this, and why Paul can talk about these things as part of the marks of an apostle. It seems that an apostle could just go, jink, heal this person. It seems that way. I can't prove that, but it seems like they were just able to heal virtually at will, just like Jesus could. Now, this leads us on then in thinking about the purpose of the link between signs and wonders and belief. What is the link between these two? Is it that signs and wonders result in people believing the message? Now, this is a slightly debated area. Come back to John Wimber. He would say, yes, absolutely. He says that there's some power in counter, a miracle's performed, a healing or something supernatural happens. And he definitely said, people would believe because of the miracle, because of the supernatural event. Well, I think there is a link, a very clear link, between signs and wonders and belief. But I don't think it's as simple as you see a miracle, so you believe. I hear a couple of verses about Jesus' signs, for example. Even after Jesus had done all these miraculous signs in their presence, they still would not believe in him. So clearly, you can see signs and wonders and not believe. Another one, the Pharisees, you remember, came to him and said, "We want to see a miraculous sign from you." And he said, "A wicked and adulterous generation asks for a miraculous sign, but none will be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah," which is about a reference to his resurrection. In other words, it's possible to want to see signs and wonders wrongly. To say, "Go on, prove yourself, then I'll believe you." And Jesus says, "No, I'm not performing on demand like that." And I presume that's because if that's someone's attitude, seeing the miracle won't result in belief anyway. This is why I say it's a slightly debated area, because clearly there are other verses prove, you know, say God testifies to it. It seems to result in belief or help belief, and yet it doesn't necessarily result in belief, so much so that Jesus can say, "I'm not going to show you one." And a very important passage in this regard is in 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 1 and 2. Paul says that the Jews demand signs and the Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. So he's in a context in Corinth, it seems, where the Jews are saying, "Go on, show us a sign. Prove yourself to us." And my understanding of these words is that he said, "In which case, I'm not doing any signs. All I'm doing is preaching Christ crucified, which you will think of as it'll be a stumbling block or foolishness." So it's a passage we could spend all morning on, but effectively he's got one group saying, "Prove it with signs," and another group, the Greeks, saying, "Show us how clever you are, prove it with wisdom." And he says, "I'm not doing either. I'm just preaching the cross. And you'll stumble because you'll say, 'Well, that's rubbish,' and you'll think it's foolishness. I don't mind." So he goes on in the next chapter to say, "I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Christ and him crucified. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on men's wisdom, but on God's power." Now, those are words that you'll find quoted in books like Power Evangelism. And they will quote, not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power. And so there you go. It's proved. My problem is that a few verses earlier, the Jews demand signs, but I preach Christ crucified. So whatever he means by a demonstration of the Spirit's power, I don't think it's as simple as "I perform signs and wonders for you." And in fact, if we went back a few more verses, Paul has already defined what he means by God's power. He said, "The message of the cross is foolishness to some, but to those who are being saved, it is the power of God." And when he says, "I resolve to know nothing with you except Christ and him crucified," I think it has to be that he saw the power as being in the message of the gospel. We know he thought that, Romans 1:16. The gospel is the power of God for the salvation of people. And I think that's what's going on here. Now, we're going to have some questions at the end, hopefully, and you can get back to me on some of that if you want to. And I'm sorry, I'm having to move relatively quickly because we could do a whole study on that section. But I would suggest that here is another example of people wanting signs to believe and Paul saying, "No, I don't want your faith to rest on what you see or on the cleverness of the argument. I want your faith only to rest on the power of God, that is the message of the gospel. We can come back to that. We're thinking about how signs result in belief, and I'm basically saying there is a link, but it's not automatic. But let's just strengthen the link that there is, and we'll come to the memory verse. Jesus did many other miraculous signs, which are not recorded, but why has John written his seven signs that he writes in his gospel? He's written them that you may believe. I've written down these signs to result in belief. This is why I say signs should lead you to belief, because they give the evidence that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. So I think, yes, that arrow I had up earlier on, signs should result in belief, but A, it's not automatic. You see the sign, it doesn't mean you believe. B, we mustn't think that means that if people say, show me a sign and I'll believe you, we shouldn't fall for that. Jesus didn't think it worked that way. And ultimately, of course, the sign isn't what you believe in the message. That's where the power is. The sign only points you to the message and says, believe this. There's good evidence to believe this. There's good evidence to believe Jesus is this person and does these things. We can come back to that. Let's draw things together. Signs and wonders, then, in our evangelism today. Well, there is clearly one sense in which signs and wonders should be used in our evangelism today, and that is in looking back at the signs in the Bible. See, John 20, what we just looked at, says, these are written so that you'll believe. And so I take it those signs and wonders we should still look back on as a reason to believe. And this, of course, is only what Peter did. We looked at that one where he stood up and said, Jesus of Nazareth, you know, was a man accredited by God. So he stood up and told people, you should believe in Jesus. God put his endorsement on him through signs and wonders, ultimately through the sign of the resurrection. And I think those things should give us confidence in the truth of the gospel, and they should be part of our evangelism. People say, why should I believe this stuff? Well, read what Jesus did. Read what the apostles did. Look at the evidence for the resurrection, for example. Not that evidence will force you to believe, because it could be proved, you know, plain as day and you still wouldn't believe. But we still see that link. Do you see what I mean? And I think this is an area we've been slightly embarrassed about sometimes. It's like, oh, I know there are miracles in the Gospels and, you know, find them a bit hard to believe today and so on. Actually, we should be the other way around. We should be, there are miracles in the Gospel. Jesus did amazing things. And that's good reason to believe in Jesus. But I don't think the rest of the New Testament leads us to expect current day signs and wonders in the same way as we saw them then. And I emphasize the same way. Let me argue that through a second. First of all, we see no mention of this in what you might think of as the ongoing commands within the New Testament. So, for example, Paul writes to Timothy or Titus about how they should go on in pastoral ministry and leading churches, and he says things like, preach the word and suffer for the gospel and hold on to the truth of the gospel and so on. And he never says, and perform signs and wonders. Now, that is an argument from silence, but I think it's a fairly significant silence. Then there are those phrases we looked at, like in Hebrews 2, which said, we have the message of salvation made more certain because God confirmed it. And it has the sense of God has done something to go stamp of approval, confirmed it, therefore we now are more certain living this side of those things. Rather than God keeps on confirming it all the time throughout history. And then there's things like the John 20 passage, I've written these things so that you'll believe. Well, John puts that in just after Jesus speaks to Thomas. And Thomas, to Thomas, he says, you believe because you've seen me. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. Now, that's about the resurrection, but that is, I think, the ultimate sign. And I think Jesus is there looking forward to the time when people won't have the evidences that Thomas had. And says they'll have to believe without seeing. And immediately after that, John writes, Jesus did lots of other miraculous signs, but I've written these so that you'll believe. And so I think he sees that people will look back and believe rather than having ongoing evidence. Now, having said that, church history and indeed current events around the world would say there are clearly miraculous events happening. I have no doubt about that at all. I know some remarkable things. I was reading of a missionary in East Malaysia, for example, where in discussing things with discussing Christianity with a tribe, God gave a very clear example of kind of supernatural protection where somebody tried to come and kill the missionaries and were unable to for amazing reasons. It was actually something about they basically suddenly they couldn't pick up their knives. It's like they were too heavy and they just couldn't pick them up to kill these people. And they were like, they just couldn't believe it. And there seems to be no other explanation other than God miraculously protected them. And that, of course, then was evidence to those people that God was on the side of these missionaries, and they ought to take what they're saying seriously. But, of course, there are then also examples of missionaries being killed. So the supernatural protection, for example, doesn't just function all the time. Indeed, you'd have to say more are killed than are protected in that example. Or, for example, you get examples of healing. So I've read again this past week of situations in which a missionary would pray for some child in a village situation, and the child would be healed, and that would result in the missionaries being welcomed and being taken more seriously within that village. And again, you think, well, there's a sign authenticating these missionaries. But of course, there are also multiple occasions where no such healing takes place. And indeed, the same person quoted an example where a witch doctor performed healings and the missionaries didn't. So it's not as simple as you can just go and do it, I would say, on today's evidence. That's not a biblical argument, that's just looking at what seems to be happening. And I'd say the same thing about healings today. And in the West, that is the major area where people still talk about signs and wonders, kind of healing crusades and so on. And we could have a whole sermon on this now. I just want to make one point, really, and that is that the healings seen at those sorts of meetings today, if indeed there are any, are of a completely different order to what was going on with Jesus and with the apostles. So, for example, I went to a healing meeting here in Leicester 2 or 3 months ago. You know, hundreds of people going up, being prayed for, and so on. And the guy at the front had to say, well, you might not be healed tonight. You might have to come back several times or whatever. And it might be partial and lots of sort of caveats put in. And to my mind, rather unhelpfully, then also saying the blind will see and the deaf will hear and those with cancer will be driven out. So on the one hand, you have caveats. And on the other hand, you have great claims. Whereas with the apostles and with Jesus, and what was that one we looked at? You know, people lying, people in the street, so that as Peter walked down the street, his shadow fell on them, and they were healed. Or, you know, people with a paralyzed arm, Jesus says, reach out, and it's whole. If we could do today what we read here, we could go up to the LRI this afternoon, we could empty some wards. But I'm afraid nobody does that today. The claims say we're healing cancer and so on, but no one goes to a cancer ward and sends them home that afternoon. I'm sorry, but they just don't. And so in one sense, what we see in Acts proves too much for those who want to say we carry on with signs and wonders. Because the fact is, we don't do it like they did it. Now, we could get into a big discussion on healing, and I could say more on that. But I want to make that point to say again, we don't expect it in the same way. I'm not saying that God doesn't heal. I know of some situations where I'd say God worked wonderfully, miraculously there. And the doctors were flabbergasted and so on. Absolutely. But I don't think we can walk out and say to my neighbour, oh, you've got a bad back. In the name of Jesus, see, you ought to believe the gospel. And I know that's a simplistic presentation, but you see what I mean? See the difference? I don't say I think I've got that expectation that God will always do it like that, as I think he did it then. So, I think we do see signs and wonders today, but I don't think we see them in the same way. So let's summarise. Should we pray the prayer of Acts 4:30? Let's have the prayer up again. Stretch out your hand to heal and perform miraculous signs and wonders through the name of your holy servant, Jesus. Well, I hope I've made clear that I think when they prayed that prayer, they did it knowing that God was authenticating the ministry of the apostles through these signs and wonders, and they could do it at will. And so they prayed to God saying, please keep doing it so that the message would go forward. Well, you probably guessed from what I've said, I don't think we can pray that prayer in the same way or at least with the same expectation. But I do think we can pray it because I do think on occasion God works wonderfully and miraculously to vindicate his name and to authenticate the message. So ultimately, it's a difference of expectation. And I think back here, we read of a time where God was kind of guaranteeing to do it through certain people all the time. And now he may do it wonderfully. He seems to be doing it more in mission situations and so on. But we don't have the expectation that this is what he'll do all the time. But neither should we be scared of praying to God, please work in an amazing way. And I think sometimes we can back off from that. Well, there you go. Those are my thoughts on signs and wonders today. We've got a couple of minutes. I'm sure some people have at least some questions. I've told you virtually everything I know, so I can't promise to shed any more light. But I thought it might be helpful just to have a few questions before we close, if people have got any, or comments to fill in, to add something that'll enrich our thinking. John.
I asked you about 1 Corinthians 12, gifts of the Spirit.
Yeah.
You talked about people having miraculous powers and powers of healing and so on. And also James chapter 5, where the elders to get together.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Excellent question. So 1 Corinthians 12 talks about gifts of miracles and healing. James 5 talks about going to the elders of the church and praying. The elders of the church praying for people who are sick and they're being healed. This is why at the beginning I said I wanted to focus on signs and wonders and evangelism, because I think I'd say of both those passages, they're more about what happens within the church than about going down the street and so on. In one sense, that's a whole nother discussion. What expectations should we have of miraculous working today? My brief answer to that would be we should expect God to gift people to perform miracles of some kinds. It seems to me that we don't see that a great deal today, certainly in this sort of church. And I think there's a challenge for us there to either have a different explanation or to say to God, come on, God, what does this look like today? And I, for where I'm at, I take that as like an open challenge. I don't know kind of quite where to go with that, I'll be quite honest. James 5 is harder just because of the context in James. A lot of stuff about people being double-minded and the results that can have in people's lives. And is it effectively, some would argue, it's a spiritual sort of healing. And I... Yes, it's linked with being forgiven and so on. And I simply haven't done the close work on James 5 to be able to comment. I know there are different positions on it, and I'm not sure what I think at the moment. So maybe we should have a topical thing on healing today. Yeah. Well, I've done it myself. And in fact, on one instance I know of what you'd think of as a more miraculous moment was the elders going and praying. The problem, in a sense, is that James 5 seems to say they will be healed. And I've done that a handful of times, and only once were they healed, and I know of many others. So what do we do with that? I'm not sure. Other contributions, questions?
You just mentioned the question of faith, the recipients.
Yeah.
Because there seem some examples on the gospel. Jesus says, it seems to me that it's their faith that counts.
Yes.
And others where it doesn't.
Yep. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this brings in, and in this sense, John Wimber wasn't wrong to talk about the faith of the recipient. Mark 6, for example, Jesus could do no miracles there because of their lack of faith. And yet elsewhere, it doesn't seem to return on their faith. And so that, again, is a very involved area. The one thing I'd say about our topic for this morning is, I don't think that should be a factor in signs and wonders in evangelism, because I wouldn't expect a non-Christian to have faith. So again, that's more of an in-house discussion of what we expect to see happen in the church. Well, thank you. It's another big issue.
Why is it different
today?
You saying about signs and wonders in the church?
Yeah.
And that was useful for a lot. And then today we don't
say
that so much.
So. Yeah. So why the change? Sorry, I hoped to have made that clearer. Because I think what. If you like, a rather reductionistic picture of how God acts in history, say like with the Exodus, first of all, and then with Jesus and the cross and resurrection and ascension, is that he does an act of salvation and confirms the people involved in it, testifies to, say, Moses, to Jesus and to the apostles, and then he calls on people to look back and believe in that message and to the testimony and evidence that there were, rather than performing either new acts of salvation all the time throughout history, or performing like new resurrection appearances of Jesus, or new signs of wonders in the same way. So it's like he does it in history, he confirms it in history, and we then look back to it. I think that is a biblical pattern. But it's not a watertight case in the sense, as I've been saying, I do think things will carry on a little. It's just not in the same way. He did it like that then because he wanted to put his stamp on the message of the gospel as it first emerged into the world. Best I can do. Yeah.
This is just off the top of my head. I'm wondering, because like, you have the account of another quite a time in the Old Testament where there was some miraculous things
going
on. That was a specific, kind of quite a spiritual war. There's a lot of persecution, and there's an awful lot about suffering, isn't there, and ongoing, and the believers really being crushed. I just wonder then, maybe, if that's why some of the places we do still seem to see some more miraculous signs and wonders in the world are those places where there is that head-on battle and suffering persecution thing. I don't know, maybe that's where it comes out a bit more again.
Yeah, lots of people would say that, that where there is either some sort of satanic stuff going on, like worship, or at least other religion stuff going on, like worship of ancestors or something in an African tribal situation or something like that, or where there's more severe persecution, God will act more often in this way. And I'd say, I think that's probably has some truth to it, but more people suffer than get supernaturally protected. So you think of, I don't know, Jim Elliot and the others in Ecuador. How did God, in a sense, give testimony to that tribe that they ought to listen to this message? He didn't do it by supernaturally protecting the people or performing any miracles. I think he did it by people going back and by people persistently loving that tribe, no matter what they'd done to their husband and so on. So Jim Elliot's son, for example, went as a missionary to the same tribe. Jim Elliot's son was baptized by one of the men who'd killed his father. That's just one example, but I take it that God, in one sense, God gives his evidences in these ways, effectively through the love and the godliness and the perseverance of Christians. And that, I think, is his normal way of giving evidence to the truth of the gospel, other than its inherent power. Signs and wonders are his occasional way of giving evidence. And we mustn't get caught up with, I mean, the John Wimber book at the beginning, what did it have on the front? Anybody remember?
Fireworks.
Fireworks. We mustn't get caught up with the fireworks, thinking, way, when God would say, actually, I show my power through many ways, including perseverance through suffering. We better stop. I hope that's been useful. I'm sorry it's a little bit different to normal, but I hope you may have been increased in your own confidence in the truth of the gospel because God testified by signs and wonders.